All right, we're back. Thanks for tuning in. You may recognize this song. Not sure whether you'll recognize the band. I'll tell you, I think I've heard of these guys. What are they called again?
Rock Bottom People. Remainders. I was going to say raconteurs because we've been talking about that. But I guess technically these gentlemen would be raconteurs.
They would be.
Because they're excellent at storytelling. I looked it up.
15 years ago in Mitch Albom's beloved novel, The Five People You Meet in Heaven, the world fell in love with Eddie, a grizzled war veteran turned amusement park mechanic who died saving the life of a young girl named Annie. Eddie's journey to heaven taught him that every life matters. Now, in this magical sequel, Mitch Albom reveals Annie's story. The accident that killed Eddie left an indelible mark on Annie. Keep this straight. It took her left hand, which needed to be surgically reattached, injured, scarred, and unable to remember why Annie's life is forever changed by a guilt-ravaged mother who whisks her away from the world she knew. Bullied by her peers and haunted by something she cannot recall, Annie struggles to find acceptance as she grows. When, as a young woman, she reconnects with Paolo, her childhood love. We need different music for this.
Yeah, exactly. Well, okay,
she believes she has finally found happiness. As the novel opens, Annie is marrying Paolo, but when her wedding night day ends, whoa, in an unimaginable accident, good night. How do you come up with this stuff? Annie finds herself on her own heavenly journey and an inevitable reunion with Eddie, one of the five people who will show her how her life mattered in ways she could not have fathomed. This is insane stuff. This is so good. This is why the guy has sold, what is it, 39 million copies worldwide. Mitch Albom, again, on the Drew Marshall Show. Mitch, welcome back. How are you today?
Hi, Drew. How are you doing?
Quite well. I don't know how you do this, man. I mean, hold on. Let's talk about something just a little bit closer to my heart. I just watched the Leafs-Red Wings game the other day. Did you happen to see that?
No, I've been on the road. What happened?
Well, it was just some incredible hockey. Finally, the Leafs, seems like they've turned a corner, and the Red Wings look phenomenal. And correct me if I'm wrong, but are they not your hometown peeps? Well, not hometown, but that's where you're at.
They're my hometown team, and your Toronto management is our hometown team, too.
Okay, really? You got to bring that up? Jeez. Okay, well, that...
Brendan and your coach are really good guys, and I really like working with them, and I'm glad that they're having success in Toronto.
They're also Canadian.
Yeah, let's get that point across.
Yeah, baby.
You lent them to us in the first place. We returned them, yeah.
Thank you. Mitch, I want to do a little fact-checking, and of course, being Mitch Albom, the sports journalist, I figured you might appreciate this. So can we do a couple of fact-checking things? I want to see if Wiki is true. You ready?
Okay.
He's like, really? We're going there? Okay. October 22nd, 2007, Mitch Albom appeared with former New York Governor Mario Cuomo and Tony Bennett in an evening with Tony Bennett to honor the release of Bennett's Tony Bennett in the Studio, Life of Art and Music, for which Albom wrote the foreword. True or not true?
100% true.
Dude, first of all, how is Tony Bennett still alive?
Tony's a miracle. He takes very good care of himself, and he's not only alive, still singing.
I know, yeah.
And he and I became friends, I want to say it's almost probably 10 or 15 years ago. I got asked by Parade Magazine to write a feature about him. And, you know, I was a musician before I was a writer, so some people know that, and occasionally I get asked to write things about music, and he's a modern miracle. He's a wonderful, amazing singer with a huge heart, and I hope he lives to 190.
With his heart being left in San Francisco.
I remember that night.
Apparently you also wrote the song Hit Somebody, otherwise known as the hockey song, which was recorded by singer-songwriter Warren Zevon with David Letterman on backup vocals. The song was released as a single in Canada and adapted into a film by director Kevin Smith, apparently. You currently perform with the Rock Bottom Remainders, a band of writers that also features Dave Barry, Stephen King, Ridley Pearson, Amy Tan, Kathy Kamen, Goldmark, Sam Barry, and Scott Turow. Is any of that fabricated? Any of that fabricated?
Not one bit. That's all true. Wow. Weird as it is.
And did we not just play a song from your boys, your posse?
Yeah, you know, I was listening to that as you know, I'm on a phone, so it's not so easy to hear, but I said, oh, we do that song. And then I realized, wait a minute, that's us doing that song.
Wait a minute.
So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Last couple of ones here, and we'll get on to the book, because, you know, there's a lot to talk about. On November 22nd, 2005, Mitch Albom was the sole and final guest on Ted Koppel's farewell appearance on ABC's Nightline. Koppel had gotten to know Mitch through his broadcast with Maury Schwartz, and the final program dealt with the legacy of those shows and Albom's book. True story?
Yeah, 100% true.
Dude.
Ted Koppel and I did the last Nightline show together about 2 days with Maury, and I think of all the years that Ted Koppel did Nightline, he said that the most memorable interviews were those ones that he did with Maury. Mm. And, you know, my book was obviously about Maury. And so, yeah, we shared that together.
I take this the wrong way, because I'm not going to say this right, but you're a bigger deal than I thought you were.
Okay. I don't want to know what you thought I was, but I guess I should say thank you for that.
I also write for Hallmark. In 2000, at the Emmy Awards, Mitch Albom was personally thanked by actor Jack Lemmon during his acceptance speech for his Emmy for Best Actor in TV Movie or Miniseries for Tuesdays with Maury. And that would be Mr. Lemmon's last major acting role. True story. All of that is true.
That's 100% true. And Jack Lemmon was just a darling man, and he actually was dying from cancer when he made that movie. Nobody knew that, and he shared that with me, and so I knew that that was going to be a special role for him anyhow. And when it was finished and they did the movie, he and I were talking on the phone, and I said, well, just remember, when you win the Emmy Award, because you're going to win an Emmy Award for this, don't forget to thank the writer, because they always forget to thank the writer. Awesome. They thank the babysitter and the dog groomer and everybody. And I was teasing him. He goes, okay, you know, and this is way, way before the Emmy Awards. And then he did get nominated, and then he did win. And sure enough, as soon as he got up there, I think the first thing he said was, first of all, I want to thank the writer, Mitch, because Mitch says that we always forget the writer, so I'm thanking the writer. So he kept his word.
There's a guy I would have loved to have interviewed. Jack Lemmon.
Yeah, he was an amazing man and so sweet.
Yeah.
And I felt bad for him because, you know, I didn't know him until I met him on the set, and he was already facing his mortality, you know, so he wanted to talk. He didn't want to talk about the role. He wanted to talk about what Maury had taught me and had said about dying so that he could utilize it himself. So we got close very fast, you know. It wasn't a sort of peripheral kind of relationship, and he's a really good man, and his son is a good guy too.
Okay, let's get talking about this book. And Tim, by the way, can you take this book and go hold it up to our Facebook streaming live camera so that our...
Sure, I was trying to find an actual copy of him.
No, don't do what you want to do. Do what I want you to do. There it is. Well done, Tim. You're holding that up so well. First of all, Mitch, just listening to your voice, do you happen to do a Christopher Walken impersonation? Because I think you would nail it.
I don't speak like that all the time.
No, never mind.
Who is this guy that's trying to talk like me?
This guy? Mitch, what informs your imaginings of heaven? Give me maybe two or three things that inform your imaginings of heaven, because that's what you're kind of writing about. That's what you're known for.
Yeah, well, both the five people you meet in heaven and this new one, the next person you meet in heaven, come from an idea that my uncle, whose name was Eddie, and it was based, the character Eddie, who's in both books, was based on. He was a World War II vet and a kind of gruff sort of, you know, I'm a nobody, I'm a nothing kind of guy, blue-collar worker. And he told me about a night that he died, technically, while he was having open-heart surgery. And he said that he lifted above his body and floated over the bed and saw all of his dead relatives waiting for him. Of course, as a kid hearing the story, we would always say, well, so what did you do, Uncle Ed? What did you do? And he said, what did I do? I told him, get the heck out of here. I'm not ready for any of you yet. And apparently they flew back to heaven, and he went back in his body, and he lived a little bit longer. But to me, you know, that was always my, and still is, my belief about what happens when we die, because, you know, he's my uncle. He wasn't going to lie to me, and I believed him. And so I took that idea and just sort of tweaked it a little bit. I said, well, what if people waiting for you aren't all your relatives? What if some of them are just people you may have met once in life, but that meeting changed your life and changed their life forever? So that became the basis for The Five People You Meet in Heaven, and then, of course, that became the basis for the sequel.
Okay, but do you, you know, I have this idea in my head that you consult, like, heaven experts. Do you consult theologians? Do you consult Ozzy Osbourne? Like who do you consult?
No, that just came up from my own imagination. But, you know, I'm not trying to say this is how heaven works. And in both books, there's a couple paragraphs before we start the story saying, please, this is a fable.
Yeah, lighten
up. Wish.
Yeah.
I hope. But please don't anybody think, you know, I've done nonfiction research. You know, I've gone there, checked it out. This is exactly how it works. It's meant to reflect back on our lives, you know, and it was written, the first book was written for people who think that they're kind of nobodies and don't matter, like Eddie did. And so the idea of going to heaven, for me, if heaven answers all your questions, and of course one of those questions would be, well, how did my life matter? Because I thought it didn't. And in the new book, Annie, the little girl that he saves, goes through life thinking that everything she does is a mistake. And everything she touches kind of goes wrong because of the incident that happened when she was 8 years old. And my message is, again, you know, nobody is doomed to make mistake after mistake after mistake. The mistakes we make open opportunities to do other things. The wrongs we do open opportunities to understand what right is and do that. So in each case, heaven is used as a way of sort of explaining life to the characters who are in it, but not because, hey, this is how heaven works,
yeah,
but more like this is what life was about.
I can imagine, though, that over the years, Mitch, that you have received much correspondence from people trying to inform you about what they think heaven is really like. Do people, you know, get up in your grill about this?
No, not in an angry way. I actually had I remember a man who came to a book signing once, and he was crying. He sort of grabbed onto me and wasn't sure what was wrong, and he said, in the first book, the last word of the book is home. And as it is in this one, and he said that his wife had died a couple weeks earlier, and she was sort of in a coma, had been for a while, he'd been by her bedside, and then just at the final moment, her eyes opened, and she said, home, and then they closed, and she was gone. And
man,
so he said to me, how did you know, you know, and I had to say, I don't know, I didn't know. I'm glad to hear that that's what happened, but don't credit me with anything. So it's more like that. Nobody really, it's amazing, Drew, because, you know, the book sold a lot of copies, and you would think for along the way maybe somebody would take issue with it, but they didn't. I think everybody sort of understands that it's a fable, and in fact it's been embraced in churches and synagogues, you know, across different religious lines. So I think the idea of our life mattering and us all connecting with one another is kind of woven into a lot of major faiths dogmas,
yeah,
anyhow, and they find a way to embrace the story.
You know, what I find interesting, Mitch, is how Christians like to write about hell and the Jews seem to write about heaven. Explain that to me.
I didn't think, I've never heard that observation, but I don't have an answer for it.
Okay.
That's a good question. That's a research topic.
No, but look, all my Jewish friends that I talk to, I mean, you know, you guys don't really get into the hell thing. It's not part of your thing.
Well, actually, in Judaism, there is no concept of hell,
right,
and there's no really clear concept of heaven either. There's something that's called Olam Haba, or the world to come, and, you know, there's some vague references to life being sort of balanced out there, but it's nowhere near the very detailed sort of idea of eternal life and that Christianity offers with Jesus or other religions offer, too. So it's odd that Jewish people would write about. Maybe that's why they have to imagine it.
Sure.
I don't know.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Well, look, man, you write a lot about loss, but I love... So I'm also a hospital chaplain. I grew up in the funeral business. I used to be a pastor. I'm now a hospital chaplain, and I do that on the side. it's like making
it's a
pizzas.
Business. Yeah, right, there we go.
But I've been around death my whole life, and my experience with death has allowed me to appreciate life. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. So is mine, and unfortunately, there's been a lot of it.
Yeah. So you've had just a crazy 3 years, man. I mean, what the heck? You lost both your parents, as well as your beautiful 7-year-old adopted Haitian daughter. Is it Chica? Is that how you say your name?
Chica. Yes.
And so let me just stop the interview with all the schmaltzy stuff and say, dude, that sucks, man. That is just crap. I got there's nothing anybody can say that's going to make you feel all warm and fuzzy after that kind of stuff.
No, but you know, I had to channel it into something positive, or else, you know, you'd just be weeping all day long. And in fact, there's a moment in this book which was really just created almost as therapy for me. But Annie, the little girl who's now grown up, who's going through heaven, she meets somebody in heaven, and she's complaining about her losses and how she lost the people she cared about and things that she had, you know, were breaking her heart, her experiences. And this character takes these pipe cleaners, which play a role in the book, and he takes one little pipe cleaner and he makes a small, perfectly shaped heart out of it. And he says, "You see this heart? This is the heart that we're born with. It's small, it's perfect, it's unlined." Then he takes four other pipe cleaners and he makes this very big heart with lines all across it. And he says, "You see this heart? This is the heart we die with." And she says, "Well, it's all broken." And he says, "That's right, many times." And she says, "Well, so that's what ruins it." And he says, "No, that's what makes it whole." And that's what I have to believe, and honestly believe, that all those heartbreaks that we've suffered, the three that you just mentioned of mine, but everybody who's listening who has their own, they break our heart and they line our heart, but also they're the marks of living a long life and appreciating what you still do have and cherishing the time that you have. You know, if we never lost anything, we never appreciate anything because we just figure we're going to have it forever, kind of like kids. Mm-hmm. And so it's the losses that sort of make us hang on to the things that we have, and all those little lines across our heart are part of that process. And I wrote that as much for me as I did for the readers, to just sort of get through, especially losing a child, and no one should have to endure that. And that's how I've tried to look at it. I always say we didn't lose a child, we were given one. And I think if you have that attitude towards loss, it at least it'll carry you through and keep you from breaking down and crying every 5 minutes.
Yeah, I don't think I could get there. I don't think I could get to that. I've heard that many times. You know, we didn't lose a child. We had the blessing and the privilege of having this child for a little bit, but this child was never ours, blah, blah, blah. That's just all cognitive. I don't know. I don't think I could really, really believe that, you know? Can you give me some advice? Because I've always kind of said, Mitch, and Tim, again, you know where I'm going with this. I've said this like 30 times in the show. You know, if there is a God, God and I have this sort of unspoken arrangement. Screw with me all you want. But once my kids, something goes down with them that's horrific, you know, or I don't know, whatever, you and I are done.
Well, you know, you're going to have to rectify that in your own mind. I mean, I think, you know, I don't know about the business, but they were never ours and all that. I've heard that expression.
Yeah.
But I do think that, you know, in fact, I write it on the first page of the book. Annie was supposed to die in the first book. Instead, she gets pushed out of the way, and she lives, and Eddie dies. And then she gets older, and finally she dies. And I say, you know, you might say that she died too young, but you could also say she was already older than she was supposed to be, you know, because she was saved. How do we know how many times things have happened to us that have spared us? How do we know, you know, we weren't given opportunities to go on when life was otherwise going to take us away? So whether you look at it at age 7 or age 70, what's too old for life? You know, we lost Chica when she was 7, but I know people who've lost children after 3 days. And so, you know, I'm not an advice giver, Drew. But actually, liking you and wishing that you would, you know, have more comfort with it, I wish I could say something that would put a spin on it that wouldn't make you angry with God, because I don't know where that gets you. You know?
No, well, I've tried it.
The argument.
No, I've tried I've tried that on for a few years now, and it hasn't gotten to me anywhere. And I think one of the first times I kind of got my gut up, you know, figuratively got up in God's grill, mm-hmm. Was when I came out of the Holocaust Memorial in Israel, out of the Children's Memorial. That was not a good scene, man. Not a good scene. So I don't know how you.
Been there. It's called Yad Vashem, and I've been there, and I've seen it, and it'll absolutely break your heart. And I have relatives who lost their entire families in that event. But if you're blaming God for that, you're jumping right over Adolf Hitler, and you know, he wasn't a god; he was a man, and man did that.
Yeah.
Man did that. God didn't allow man to do that. Man did it. And if you believe in free choice, and we have the we have the, you know, free will, we have the ability to choose the best of us or the worst of us, then that was an example of the worst of us.
Yeah, I get the whole free will thing. I really do. I've said that many times to many others. You know, we live in a world where we have, if there is love, there has to be the opposite of love. There has to be choice. There has, you, in, real love involves a choice. I can't make someone love me. And that means that if there's choice, there's free will, and you get evil, you get good. I get all that. But, I mean, these were supposed to be your people, you know, God's chosen people. It was like, well, then how did you, anyway. I'm on a rant now. Let's go back to the book. HarperCollins Canada presents Mitch Albom, best-selling author of The Next Person You Meet in Heaven. MitchAlbom.com is the website. Mitch Albom is pretty much a freaking rock star when it comes to books. I guess I should say that in a better way. He's an internationally renowned and best-selling author, journalist, screenwriter, playwright, radio and television broadcaster, musician. Apparently he has ADD. Wow. You are all over the place. His books have collectively sold millions. I wonder who sold more books, you or Paul Young. Have you done a count?
No, I haven't.
Okay. That Shaq book did pretty well as well. But your stuff is just penetrating people. And I think, honestly, it's scratching where the itch is, man. That's why. You know. You understand the itch of humanity, if that makes any weird sense at all. Well done.
If it is, I have the same itch. So that's why.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Listen, Mitch, thanks again for coming on the show. I really appreciate your time. I always do. Thank you.
Thank you, Drew. Appreciate talking with
you. Okay. Bye-bye. Mitch Albom on the Drew Marshall Show. He just gets it, man. He seems to, well, I already said it. You know, collectively as a society, there's a yearning,
yep.
And he speaks into that somehow, and I like how he doesn't, this is where we resonate. I don't have any answers.
Nope. And I think that goes back to the whole thing that you struggle with, this statement about we had this child for a while. We're trying to justify, we're trying to understand it, and sometimes things just can't be understood. And I think what you're talking about here is people trying to figure things out, and maybe some sort of metaphor will help them at least on the journey there. I don't know.
Yeah.